as to any communications which have occurred, but apparently they have not occurred between my staff and Representative Kopetsky and the sponsors of this bill. Interestingly enough, we did bring an action against counterfeiters of Cabbage Patch dolls just prior to last Christmas under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and were successful in getting immediate court action to stop it. Whether that, of course, did not provide the manufacturer with any civil remedy or any other form of recompense for lost profits. The other thing that occurred to me as I was listening to counsel from Seattle was the possibility of a civil RICO action brought as a private action by a manufacturer, at least in those occasions where the activity of the counterfeiter violates federal statutes. If you can find two predicate offenses under the Federal Civil RICO Act, you have available all those very powerful ranges of remedies as a private litigant without even the involvement of the state under a federal civil RICO. There must be some reason why that's not been used, so I'm not suggesting that counsel has overlooked that. But clearly, if you're looking at a pattern of criminal activities, counterfeiting, violation of import duties, or whatever else is involved, it could be that a federal civil RICO action or a state private civil RICO action would be a remedy for the manufacturer. You can use those to shut down businesses, as you well know. But these are really matters of speculation, and I hope I'm not being irresponsible just to share them with you. Those are my immediate reactions. My staff has not looked at this measure.
I appreciate your comments. Now, if Ms. Diamond were to contact your office, who would she call? Because I'm going to ask her to have your staff look at this bill.
Fine. She would call Timothy Wood, the attorney in charge of the financial fraud section. Tim Wood.
Tim Wood.
Or David Slater, the business and consumer affairs administrator.
I think the committee might like the benefit of your staff's
We would be happy to do that, and if Representative Kopetsky's office got a hold of us, we'd be happy to do
that. All right, thanks very much. Now, are you going to be first up on this next bill?
I certainly hope so.
All right, just stay right there. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2685. We will go to House Bill 2160.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Dave Fernmeyer, Attorney General, representing the Department of Justice, appearing on House Bill 2160. I'm accompanied by Assistant Attorney General Melinda Bruce, who is the Assistant Attorney in charge of the Family Law Section of the Department of Justice General Counsel Division. Ms. Bruce is an expert in matters related to juvenile law. She is experienced in the trial of termination cases. She helps to oversee the largest single section of our department, which deals with matters relating to child abuse, child support, and the like. We're here with a very direct request to the committee. This committee has twice heard my testimony on Senate Bill 522, which deals with videotaped testimony in child abuse cases. A bill limited to that kind of testimony, videotape, closed circuit television testimony. The reason that that measure was introduced and limited to civil proceedings is obviously because of some of the concerns that I earlier this year shared with the committee about attempting to utilize that technique, however desirable, in the context of a criminal proceeding. Because of this committee's schedule, apparently, and the heavy workload of the committee, we've not been able to determine that any work session has been set or will be set for further Senate bills. Yet during the time when I have testified on this bill, I have not been aware of any opposition by a member of the committee, nor the faintest whisper of opposition to this notion from any person who has testified before your committee. It's therefore our respectful request of the committee that you further amend House Bill 2160A engrossed in accordance with the proposed amendments that we have hand engrossed and delivered to committee counsel ahead of this hearing, which would add sections 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13 to the present measure, and would give this additional option to those who are involved in child abuse cases to help to avoid the traumatization of the child which occurs. I would like, if I may, Mr. Chairman, to ask Ms. Bruce to give you some concrete examples in her experience of why this bill is necessary for me.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
No, Senator Brown.
The other bill was what bill?
Senate Bill 522. And it has been heard by this committee, and I also testified on it in conjunction with another measure that was before the committee. So we're not springing any surprises on this committee. It's well aware, I believe, of the issues.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Melinda Bruce, as Mr. Bernmeyer has introduced me. For approximately 3.5 years, I handled termination of parental rights cases for the Children's Services Division in several Oregon counties. And during that 3.5-year period of time, I had approximately 25 to 30 cases which required one or more child witnesses, primarily to testify regarding sexual abuse of them by their parents. However, I did have one case which required a child to testify regarding the murder he witnessed his parents commit. Without exception, requiring children to testify in court or in a formal courtroom had an observable and dramatic effect on the child, traumatic effect. I would like to relate some of the experiences that I had with child witnesses to give the committee an indication of the need for an alternative type of presentation of testimony for children under 12 years old. There was one child, a 10-year-old, who had been sexually abused over a period of time by his mother. This child had related his story several times to a number of people and under a number of circumstances, one of which was a videotape of an interview done of him by a police officer and a caseworker, with the parent's attorney present, by the way. During that interview, the child was relaxed, was able to relate in a coherent fashion and to demonstrate what had occurred to him over a period of time. In getting this child ready to testify in court on the advice of his psychiatrist, I did not go into the details of his sexual abuse, but rather concentrated my preparation on making this child comfortable with the courtroom. That is, taking him to the courtroom over a period of time, having him observe trials in progress, and even having him observe a trial in which a child witness was testifying. He appeared to be relaxed in that context, although he got increasingly nervous over a period of time. On the day of the trial, when he walked into the courtroom, he literally was rendered catatonic at the door. He wet his pants, he could not move, he could not speak, he could not even tell the judge what his name was. He had to be carried out of the courtroom. This is a dramatic case, I submit. However, it is not that far off the mark as an example of the effect that a courtroom has on a child in any number of instances, particularly when they must be in view of their parent, most likely, who was the perpetrator of the offense.
All right, Senator Hendrickson.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Was it being in the courtroom, or was it being in the presence of their parent that they're making the accusation?
Senator Hendrickson, that's a difficult question to answer. I think if I had to choose between one or the other, I'd get the parents out of sight of the child. That does not mean that they could not be present, but the child should not be able to see the parent when the child is testifying. I do believe, however, the courtroom itself is extremely intimidating, and the child witnesses that I prepared for trial, their first entry into the courtroom, into the circuit courtroom, you can see the effect even when it's an empty courtroom. No one's even there. And then you begin to explain to the child that when they go and testify, the judge is going to be there, mom and dad are going to be there, there's going to be a court reporter, there are going to be two or more attorneys, depending on whether or not the child is represented. There may be spectators sitting in the rear of the courtroom, and you can see a change in expression on these children's faces. Now, most of these children have testified in juvenile court prior to the time that they get to circuit court. That is a more relaxed atmosphere. I believe that that's an easier process for the child. However, the presence of the parents or the child being able to see the parent during that testimony has the same effect. And the contrast between the child giving his or her statement in a more informal atmosphere and without having to see the parent, and to the effect that testifying in the courtroom has on the child is remarkable in my experience. It's not that these children are unable to relate what they witnessed and what they experienced. It's that they are unable to do it in the fashion that we require them to do it.
Any other questions?
All right.
Senator Warren?
You set up two options here. Is there any advantage to setting any criteria on how they'd be chosen between? What I'm thinking is, if the judge is confronted with the option of having the child testify where your option one here in sub one, closed circuit television versus video. I'm not experienced in this like you are, but I'm wondering if it might be much more attractive for efficiency's sake to go number two route, the video, and if there may be some advantages for the sake of reliability and accuracy to have the closed circuit television. I'm not quite sure why I think that, but I...
you want to take a step in?
You may tell me that's wrong, but just for the sake of my question, if it were true that one was more apt to get you reliable testimony than two, and if you make the two parallel, they seem to be equally accessible to the court, if the court would be more apt to select two for the sake of convenience, is there any advantage for the sake of searching for truth to have some preference given to one?
Senator Juarez, let me speak to that issue, if I may, rather than Ms. Bruce. I think at this point, because this is not a procedure that we have presently been able to use in Oregon, that we simply don't know which will more appeal to the court. I see no personal problem with, and that's why we have presented it in the alternative, with leaving the issue in the discretion of the court as to which of the options would be better. If you pass this bill, as we fervently hope that you do, we would certainly be back here first thing one biennium from now to tell you what our experience has been and whether one option is clearly more preferable than the other. But right now, a priori, I'm not sure that anyone is in a position to say which would be the better of the two, and therefore it seems a sound enough reason to leave in the discretion of the court.
What I'm thinking is that circuit court judges handle civil, criminal, juvenile, and so forth matters, but they're very accustomed in the tort area of using videotape for perpetuation of medical and other expert testimony. That's what makes me think that there would be a tendency to rather immediately select two to be done in before the date of the hearing and so forth.
Senator Juarez, if I may, I believe that the option, there were two reasons for including these options. Number two, it's my recollection, was included in that for the reason that we may be able to cut down the number of times that a child is required to relate their story to either an investigator or, in this case, a trier of fact. If early on you can, and the parents are represented, you can take the child's testimony by way of videotape, you've cut down one additional time that this child has to talk about what happened. And I believe that that's one of the reasons that was included. I believe another reason it was included was an uncertainty as to which of these options was most likely to withstand a court challenge.
I know we got a lot of bills, but maybe work sessions we can take this up more. But I think there's some additional reliability to the testimony being given at the time of the hearing on the merits. I think we should do what we can to make it easier to have the child testify. But I guess the videotape option, being done quite a bit before the hearing, that removes the chance for the child has been coached, for the child's coach testimony to fall apart, which if the child has been coached, which can happen, I think we want to do everything we can to guard against that. That's the reason.
Well,
I don't want to take a lot of time.
If I may, I coaching, I don't believe occurs that often. I'm going to can't say it never happens, but in my experience, it's been rare, if ever, that's the circumstance. What happens is, just by nature of being a child, their memory works different than adults, and depending on the age of the child, the further away you get from the event, the less the child remembers. So the sooner you can get that child's testimony, that child's statement in some preserved form, the better. Also, the more often the child has to relate the story, the more chance there is of the child being susceptible to suggestion and varying. I would agree with you that the earlier you can get this on record, the better. But it's not always going to be possible.
That, Senator Wires, is why we would like to see both options preserved. Bear in mind that this is on the motion of any party. It may be that both parties will agree that one is good in one case and that in another case the videotape is the better option. It seems to me that as long as this is a matter that's within the judge's discretion and the counsel can argue about before the judge, that we ought at least to have both of those options available. And dependent on the specific circumstances of a case, may we be very clear that one or the other is the better choice.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Senator Fryer.
Well, let's see. I see there are five more witnesses signed up on this. Jess Armas. And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jess Armas. I'm Assistant Administrator of Children's Services Division. House Bill 2160 was originally filed by Children's Services Division, but many of the main components that we had at that time have been removed. However, we still strongly support this bill because of its clarification on some definitions and bringing about some additions that we think are very beneficial. We do investigate and do provide protective services to victims of all types of abuse and neglect, and the new definitions makes it clearer for reporting purposes those that we would be involved with, as well as clarifies for the professionals what kind of situations they are to report. Basically, House Bill 2160 adds the reporting law, threatened harm to a child's health or welfare, and mental injury as new categories of abuse. The mental injury, as I also mentioned, that part of the reason for making some changes will enable us to qualify for some federal funds. And one of the criteria is the inclusion of mental injury. The issues that we now have before us is that there is a category called emotional abuse and neglect. Mental injury picks that up, and what we found, not only in our reporting law, but reporting laws across the state, once you put something in the reporting law, it tends to bring those professionals together to clarify it. And it's our purpose is not just to create liability for someone, but our main purpose is to protect children and to bring the professionals together. And in most instances, when mental injury has been talked about, we have not brought the mental health professionals together with the judiciary and education and children's services, as well as the medical providers, and we think this will be a vehicle to partially do that. Plus, if we receive the federal funds, one of the projects that we would be using those funds for would be education and clarifying this area, because it is an important area. The bill also clarifies sexual exploitation, considers it abuse, and helps identify those situations where children are being exploited in pornography. Neglect is redefined as negligent treatment of a child, which includes failure to provide adequate food, clothing, shelter, and medical care, and it encourages reporting of those chronic cases that are also serious forms of neglect but would not necessarily lead to actual physical harm. The benefit of the definitions I've already mentioned would help qualify us for the funds from the National Center on Child Abuse and Neglect. Oregon currently is one of two states that are not qualified for those funds. The money has already been appropriated, so it isn't that we're waiting for the appropriation. What happens to those funds is, if we don't make claim on those, is that they're just redistributed to other states. So this is partially an interest that we have. The other thing that was put into this bill, which the federal legislation requires, is appointment of a guardian ad litem or special court-appointed advocate, sometimes called a CASA. This bill proposes testing it in Oregon in a model project, given the fact that we might receive the federal funds, and so that's another part of what the federal funds would go to, is to do a model test, at least one in the state. It may be advisable to do two, one in an urban county and one in a rural county. There's been a lot of question about the cost and the results of a CASA program, but this would be to actually test it in a demonstration project and then report back to the 87 legislature regarding both cost and effect of that program. The other thing that House Bill 2160 does is raises the fine for failure to report suspected abuse from $250 to $1,000. The purpose is to really show the concern for children and their safety, and to substantiate the need in the state to be concerned about the report of abuse. And basically, that's the summary of what the bill does, and we are in support of it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hexman.
I haven't actually talked to anybody about this bill, but I know in past sessions when there's been an attempt to broaden the scope of what is abuse, there's been a lot of concern on many people's parts. I know right now there's some criticism of Children's Services too much activity in terms of removing children. We heard a circuit or district court judge, which I don't know if she's district or circuit court, who holds a lot of these hearings, feeling that there's situations in which children are removed where maybe it's not the cleanest house in the world, but it's maybe more traumatic to the child to be separated from their parents than to be living in what may be a white middle-class social worker would not consider to be ideal surroundings. And I used to be a social worker before I became a lawyer, and I'm interested in juvenile law in this area. And I know it's to expand abuse to include mental injury is quite a broadening, emotional injury is quite a broadening of the law. I am pleased to see you've got due regard for the culture of the child. But with this broadening the scope of what is abuse, or the chronic neglect rather than acute situation, what insurance do we have that this is not going to be misused or too broad a discretion?
I think there's two things. One, as you know, that there's also been some attempt, and I think it's going to move ahead, to do reviews on the cases. The other is also looking at the guardian ad litem in the test part. Guardian ad litem is up front. It's one of the upfront processes to check in any abuse case where you suspect that you're going to remove a child. And the other thing is that we will be looking very closely at the whole area of mental injury. That's one across the nation that's had a lot of debate. It's had a lot of debate in Oregon. But one, you have to separate out what is just emotional disturbance in a family.
I would say that most children probably feel they're being abused by their parents, or their parents could act on them, or they cause them psychological trauma when their parents get after them.
So these have to be serious in nature. Now, what we have found is that most, what we're finding in looking at how our services are delivered, that these are usually second, third cases. It's not just a one-time report that comes in. You look at the issues around, was it actually caused by a parent, or was it just in the natural family situation that this would be there? And you have to have an observable kind of evidence for emotional.
Well, I'm sort of puzzled by the language at line 14. It says, it says any mental injury to a child, including, I'm leaving out the other one, psychological functioning of child within normal range of performance and behavior. What does that mean? What does that language mean?
I had the same question.
There is a range in normality.
I mean, it doesn't seem to grammatically make sense to me. I read it and I don't understand what it means. It says a mental injury to a child or psychological functioning of a child. Is it an injury to the psychological child outside the normal? It doesn't seem to make the language.
That's what the intent is.
It doesn't seem to say what. Counsel says I should read it with a substantial impairment of psychological function.
Yes.
But it still doesn't make very good sense within normal.
A little better, but it's
a little better, but it's still pretty awkward. What does it mean?
It means outside the normal range, and it has to be one that is substantial in the sense that it is an impairment and it's observable.
What would you call it? A psychological impairment.
When you talk too loud.
If the parent talks too loud, or the kid talks too loud.
To transsexual operations.
That's one good thing on the floor of the Senate. You can inflict all kinds of psychological impairment.
Let me offer myself to this. My name is Robert Bailey, and I'm representing the Oregon Chapter National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse. And for clarification, this is something that my organization, in addition to some others, has been pressing in several legislative seasons, and it's not something that CSD came up with. In fact, we have been partially critical that they have steered away from it.
Well, the reason they probably have is there's been so much controversy, because a lot of people have come in feeling that if you have an alternative lifestyle, or you have a different, other than a middle-class lifestyle, you're going to be found to be psychologically aberrant, and your kids are subject to be taken away then.
Right. Well, this is operating in most other states in the country, and what is meant by it is very clearly defined, observable symptoms to a child that have been documented by a bona fide expert, and an effect relationship has been traced to the parent. It's generally not a condition where a protective custody on a one-shot assessment is going to occur, but it's a process that will be assessed through time. A parent would be guided to participate in a bona fide treatment plan. A parent's failure to work with that child or respond to the treatment plan would occur through time, and a child's basically an emotional handicap, a very serious and significant injury would be documented through time, and it would be brought to court if it was brought to court under that process. So I don't think it's going to be a category where a worker goes out and identifies it on the spot. I myself have been a protective service worker in the past, and I've worked with some of these cases, and Oregon statute does provide access to these cases, but not in a very upfront fashion. And there are a lot of homework to them. And identifying what the problem is with the parent, getting the child to a identified expert to assess that, and then coming back with a work plan with the parent. So I don't think this category is going to be, you know, one of the concern areas that CSD has been criticized for.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Well, one of the other things the judge was talking about is sometimes the foster homes these kids get put in are worse than the natural parents. And is there any kind of balancing about when you're of taking these kids out of their maybe less than adequate situation about what's going to happen with them?
Well, again, I would argue that in this mental injury inclusion, it's least likely to happen where that child is taken into protective custody over an initial assessment in place. That's an assessment that's going to occur through time working with the parents. It's not one of those categories. It's going to come about quickly. And I would agree, I myself have investigated foster homes and including residential treatment centers. And I think there is a number of things that can be done, should be done, and I would advocate for those things both to Children's Services Division and the legislature. I heard Senator Wyers several weeks ago comment about a situation he directly knew of. Those things do happen. They're deplorable. And I think that there has to be some additional quality control brought into this system. Another component of this bill, particularly the guardian ad litem, we've been proposing for several legislative seasons, too, and I believe that does provide an upfront quality control person that's not on CSD's payroll, is not following CSD's policy and procedure, but is there looking at that child and what's happening to that child and whether that the removal was adequate, the foster home is adequate, the surroundings are adequate. And I think that there does need to be a very direct and immediately appointed quality controller to assist that child.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, the only other thing I was going to say is we did hear a lot of evidence that we have some, I think, the highest foster care rates in the country. So we must be taking quite a few children away right now.
Mr. Chairman.